you're listening to the wrong podcast. Topics today include certainty, scorpions, and science fiction.
Wrong!
It's the wrong podcast, but we'll make it right.
Hi, I'm Tim. I'm here to talk about politics, culture, religion, sports, and anything else you're not allowed to talk about in polite company. Issue number one! Baby Yoda! Hey, recently a new Mandalorian and Grogu movie came out. It was in fact called The Mandalorian and Grogu. I'm a big Star Wars fan. They slapped that Star Wars logo on something, and I have just made a commitment. I am handing my money over. That's the deal. We're just doing this. I'm giving you my money. And on Rotten Tomatoes, this movie, Mandalorian and Grogu, it got a 65%. And that's about what I would give it. I took my daughters. We had a good time. And going to the movies is just not something we do anymore. And it's a shame. Because it's a cultural event. It's a family event. It's something we're all going to go experience together. In this day and age where we have all of our own content on all of our own devices, I think it's a good idea to go to the movies occasionally. And this movie, like I said, it's a 65. And right now, we feel like a movie has to be in the 90s to go. And I don't know that that's always true. I think it's fine to go to a pretty good movie, even though it's not the best movie ever. I know you're going to see it later on your streaming. You like being alone. It's great. It is good to go watch a movie with other people. With people you don't know. With strangers you don't know. Go see a movie this summer. There's a new Steven Spielberg movie coming out. I don't know if it's any good. That seems like a good idea for you to go to, though. Go. Go get some popcorn. Here's my thing with The Mandalorian. This is not a spoiler. Don't worry. I'm not spoiling anything. If you like the show, The Mandalorian, you will like this movie. It is basically three episodes all smushed together into one movie. And so if you like the show, you will like the movie. It's not anything different than the show. So for some of you, there's like, well, that's all right. That you just settled it. I'm not going to go see it in the theater. Don't go see it by yourself. Go with other people. That's what I'm talking about. I have one beef with this movie. And again, this is not a spoiler. You can see this in the trailer. They have a gladiator hut. This happens to be Jabba the Hutt's son. His name is Rada the Hutt, and he is a gladiator. And he's got a six-pack, and he's got muscles, and he fights other gladiators. And come on. What are you doing? Let me just say that the first Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi was an incredibly compelling character. Really great character. And it was all done with puppetry. They had this massive suit with, I don't know, there's like five people operating this thing all together. They did great. It looks cool. Looks like a disgusting creature. And since then, over and over and over again, every time they put Jabba the Hutt in something, they do it with CGI. And it does not look good. Jabba needs to be an actual thing. It needs to be realistic. And you need to be able to touch him because these computer graphics do not do him justice. Just stop it with the computer graphic generated Jabba the Hutt. None of them look good. They started doing this, I don't know, like 35 years ago, trying to put Jabba the Hutt back in with the computer. And in 35 years, it doesn't look any better. It's still bad. Stop it. Stop trying to make Jabba out of computer graphics. Second thing. You've got a whole galaxy of possibilities. One of the reasons I like The Mandalorian and one of the reasons I like Andor is because you have a whole galaxy of new stories and new characters to explore in this world created by George Lucas. You don't need to keep going back to the well. We don't need to see Jabba the Hutt's son. Stop it. Like, what the heck? It doesn't enhance anything for me to bring Jabba the Hutt's son into it. This movie could have been made exactly the same. The plot is fine. Keep the plot. All you have to do is replace a couple of characters so that you're not talking about Jabba the Hutt's son anymore. Just, it's some gangster. It's some runaway gangster son. It doesn't need to be Jabba the Hutt. And for goodness sake, Jabba the Hutt is this gross blob wormy thing. Why are you making him, his son, a gladiator? Jabba can't move around and fight. That's part of the intrigue of Jabba the Hutt, is he's got all this power and he's just this fat blob. Anybody could walk up and kill him. He can't stop them. He's so fat and gross. He just has this personal power. And you're going to make him fight? You're going to make his son fight? What? You're ruining the character of Jabba the Hutt. Stop it. No more Jabba the Hutt. I bring all this up. I saw a quote just after I saw the movie. And Tony Gilroy is the writer and director of Andor. And I really liked Andor. I think you should watch Andor. Even if you're not really big into Star Wars, particularly if you're not really big into Star Wars, you might really enjoy Andor. Because there's no space lasers and force and flying princesses. It's just a drama about people living in an impressive empire. And you don't know the politics of everything. You don't know who's in charge. These are just people struggling through what to do about life under this totalitarian state. And Tony Gilroy, he said something to the effect of, I came to Star Wars and I was determined not to take all the toys out of the toy box. I needed to take some of the toys out, but I was going to leave more toys in the toy box than I took out. And I wish that the people who made Mandalorian and Grogu would have considered that when they were thinking about putting Jabba the Hutt's son into this movie. We don't need you to mention Jabba the Hutt for us to like this movie. We like it because of all the other worlds and creatures and space that has already been brought into the environment. Issue number two, twice stung. There was a primary election in Texas recently, and this was involving incumbent Senator John Cornyn and Texas Attorney General Paxton. What's his first name? John Paxton? Ken Paxton. That's his name. Ken Paxton. And for my money, Ken Paxton is the most disgusting, corrupt individual in politics right now. And that's saying something. That is really saying something. And Ken Paxton won this election, and I don't know that there's a deeper sign that the Republican Party has lost its way and completely abandoned the idea that it needs to be the front runner on morality and ethics and integrity, because Ken Paxton is none of those things. He is corrupt. He's so corrupt. He was impeached by the Republicans in Texas. He wasn't removed from office, which is an indictment on the Republicans in Texas, but he was impeached because he was funneling money. He was funneling state money to buy houses for his mistress. Just blatant corruption. He should be in jail. Instead, he won the primary and will be seeking election to be a United States Senator. And he was able to win this election in part because Donald Trump endorsed him. And of course, Donald Trump endorsed him. Donald Trump likes people like Paxton who offer one thing to Donald Trump, and that is full loyalty. They also offer something else, and that is their gross, disgusting character. Trump looks good with people like this around him. It makes him look normal. He doesn't have to worry about people coming after him. because their character is less than desirable itself. And John Cornyn has said everything right about Donald Trump. He just wasn't very convincing about it. Nobody actually believed him because John Cornyn is a man of integrity. And nobody could actually believe what he was saying. And if you're not fully behind Donald Trump, you're not, you don't count as a Republican right now. That's the only thing that matters. There is actually quite a bit of political diversity in the Republican Party right now, as long as you answer one question correctly. And that is, what do you think of Donald Trump? John Cornyn loses this election, this primary election, and he took to Twitter, and he posted this recently.
An old but apt fable. A scorpion wants to cross a river but cannot swim, so it asks a frog to carry it across. The frog hesitates, afraid that the scorpion might sting it, but the scorpion promises not to, pointing out that it would drown if it killed the frog in the middle of the river. The frog considers this argument sensible and agrees to transport the scorpion. Midway across the river, the scorpion stings the frog anyway, dooming them both. The dying frog asks the scorpion why it stung, despite knowing the consequence, to which the scorpion replies, "I am sorry, but I couldn't help myself. It's my character."
Someone saw what Cornyn had to say by not so transparently posting this parable on X. And her name's Charlotte Clymer, and she responded,
"Ooh, are we sharing fables? I got one for you."
So there's this frog that enters public service, presumably for the right reasons. He spends years as a district judge, then gets elected to the state Supreme Court, then Attorney General of that state. Wouldn't you know it, that frog makes his way up to the U.S. Senate and gets re-elected a few times. He seems to have a great path ahead. Well, along comes this scorpion who's running for president and saying outright, "If you don't support me, I'm gonna sting you." The supposedly wise frog warns everyone else about the scorpion, tells them this scorpion is bad news, tells them this scorpion is gonna sting them with no regard for their support. Alas, the scorpion is elected anyway, and the frog, despite knowing the scorpion is going to sting, keeps supporting the scorpion. The frog, once wise, spends a decade defending the scorpion stinging others, even though the frog knows there's a chance he's gonna get stung himself because the scorpion doesn't do loyalty. The frog, you see, is too chicken to speak out against the scorpion and decides to just wait out the scorpion's time. He's okay with others getting stung, though. He figures if he can appeal to the scorpion's ego and support him, he'll evade the eventual sting. So he spends years pandering to the scorpion and looking the other way while others get stung. And after a while, he figures he's gonna make it out okay. Well, along comes this other frog who panders even harder. A truly corrupt and nasty frog. No integrity at all. Seems to have no soul. And the frog thinks, "There ain't no way the scorpion is gonna favor this other frog. I've bent over backwards for the scorpion. I've been loyal. This other frog is ugly as sin. No one likes the other frog. The scorpion ain't gonna choose him over me, right?" The frog is now neck deep in delusion. He thinks the way to get out of this pickle is to pander to the scorpion even harder. He even tries to get a highway named after the scorpion. Well, it didn't work. One day, the scorpion thanked the frog for his loyalty and then repeatedly stung him into oblivion. Stung him over and over. Seemed to enjoy it, honestly.
I think that is apt. Loyalty is a one-way street for Donald Trump. That is obvious to all. It doesn't matter if you're a principled conservative or you're a populist MAGA type. If you break with the president, you're going to the bottom of the river. This triggered a memory for me because Donald Trump used to read a poem when he was first running for president called The Snake. And I think it's only apt for you to hear the president himself read The Snake.
Who has heard the poem called The Snake? So I have it. Does anybody want to hear it again? You sure? Are you sure? So here it is, The Snake. It's called The Snake. On her way to work one morning, down the path along the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor, half-frozen snake. His pretty colored skin had been all frosted with the dew. Poor thing, she cried, I'll take you in, and I'll take care of you. Take me in, oh tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, oh tender woman, sighed the vicious snake. She wrapped him up all cozy in a comforter of silk and laid him by her fireside with some honey and some milk. She hurried home from work that night, and as soon as she arrived, she found that pretty snake she'd taken in had been revived. Take me in, O tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, O tender woman, sighed that vicious snake. She clutched him to her bosom. You're so beautiful, she cried. But if I hadn't brought you in by now, oh heavens, you would have died. She stroked his pretty skin again and kissed him and held him tight. But instead of saying thank you, that snake gave her a vicious bite. Take me in, oh tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, oh tender woman, sighed the vicious snake. I have saved you, cried the woman. And you've bitten me, heavens, why? You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm going to die. Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
Hey, it's time. What are the rules?
Oh, what are the rules? What are the rules? Don't touch my fries or my garden tools. Oh, what are the rules? Yeah, I got my quirks. Follow them closely and I promise it works.
I was recently out to lunch with my friend Eric. We went to a place called Mod Pizza. It's one of those places where you create your own pizza and they put it in the oven. You know, Kramer's idea. And they have these sauces they put on your pizza at the end. You can choose ranch or buffalo sauce. And they have this fig balsamic thing. And the only issue is I don't want this stuff all over my pizza. I just want a little bit to dip the crust in when I'm down to just the crust. And they always, always have given you a side of this sauce if you asked for it. So they said, do you want any, you know, topping on your pizza? And I said, yes, I'd love the fig balsamic, whatever, on the side. And he goes, oh, we charge for on the side now. That will cost you 80 cents. Do you want it on the top or not? And I said, no, because I mostly didn't want to go through the hassle of paying 80 cents for this sauce, for this whatever fig balsamic dressing thing. And I was saying to my friend Eric, you know what I wanted to say was, hey, I want you to give me exactly the amount you were going to put on top of the pizza, but why don't you just put it on the side instead? Why don't we do that? To which Eric pointed out, it's the cup. They want to charge you for the cup. And I get it. They want to charge you for the stupid plastic cup. It's so true. Just give me the sauce. Why are you charging me for the cup? How about you do this instead? You've got that little plate that you're putting the pizza on. Give me another plate and put just the same amount of sauce that you would have put on top of the pizza, but sprinkle it on that plate instead. That's the rule. Remember, I want to know what's wrong with you.
What's wrong with you?
If you'd like to submit a question, topic, or tell me how I was wrong, you can email me at listen@thewrongpodcast.com or submit a comment at my website, thewrongpodcast.com. And help me spread the wrong message. If you like what you hear, share it with your friends. Now it's time for my favorite part of the show. I was wrong.
I was wrong. Oh, 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 I was wrong.
Listener Gerald, responding to my last episode, Praise and Gratitude, in which I went over the many good things that Donald Trump has done as President of the United States. Gerald had this to say.
Good episode. I can't help but note that what you at first called Trump's greatest accomplishment was something any president would have done. What you later called his greatest accomplishment is something, as you noted, that any Republican president would have done. Your closing rant in the Trump segment was a reminder of how broken American evangelicalism has become. It isn't just Trump who has become de facto pro-choice. It is also those evangelicals who seem content with Trump abandoning them on that issue. I don't think there's anyone, including Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, who could have set the anti-abortion movement as far back as Trump has.
Thank you, Gerald. For a contradictory opinion, here's listener Lisa, who actually inspired that entire segment. Listener Lisa says,
I listened to the podcast. I thought it was very, very good. Abortion has been both a political issue and a heart issue. Politically, what could be done has been done. That may be why it's not on the platform anymore. And I understand what you were saying about abortions being down under Barack Obama, but I don't totally agree with it, as I don't believe that Donald Trump is the reason why people don't join with the pro-life movement. You did an excellent job talking about all the things Donald Trump has done right. I don't blame you for not liking him.
Thank you, Lisa. And I actually agree with you in part that Donald Trump is not the reason people don't join the pro-life movement. But I truly believe, I'm going to hold fast to the idea that he is a major obstacle in encouraging other people to join with us. You cannot make a moral argument with someone like Donald Trump in your coalition. Listener Brian.
You are so wrong about Lena Khan. It is a travesty for us normies that she was forced out. She was trying to protect the people and the government from the corrupt and monopolistic telecommunications companies through net neutrality. And she was not sending the billionaires to Trump. They knew he would win and didn't want to be on his bad side. Look at what Anthropic is going through right now.
Listen, I would love to debate net neutrality because that is a normal times topic. That would be great. Let's talk about net neutrality because it's something I actually changed my mind on. I used to believe, as Brian did, and then I changed my mind. And I absolutely disagree with Brian on net neutrality. Unfortunately, we are not in the normal times and nobody cares about net neutrality. Issue number three, contradictions. Hey, as a lifelong, true believing, committed evangelical Christian, there are some things that have struck me about Christianity where we deal with contradictions in a different way. There are contradictions in our faith and in the Bible, and that may scandalize some of you. You might be saying, what are you talking about? That's not true. And let me just point out a few, and I don't believe they're a big deal. Some of them are a big deal, actually, but we don't treat them as a big deal. But the first one is, it's found in Titus 1:12. And Paul is writing, and he's complaining about the people on the Isle of Crete. And he says, one of their own prophets has said it. Cretans are always liars, evil brutes, lazy gluttons. And, you know, this doesn't necessarily fit in with our current feelings on how you talk about other people, other cultures. But people have pointed out that the Bible is false, or they've tried to point out that the Bible is false because of the self-contradictory line in Titus. One of their prophets has said, one of the Cretan prophets has said that Cretans are always liars. So the prophet is a Cretan. So that means he's always a liar. And he's saying that the other Cretans are always liars. So that means they can't all be liars. And thus the Bible is false. And this is just silly. It's ridiculous. It's so easy to overcome this. First, saying that Cretans or any group of people are always liars doesn't mean that everything they say is a lie. The prophet did not say everything they say is always a lie. He said they're always liars. That means they're prone to lie on occasion about some things. Second, the prophet is employing something known as hyperbole. It is a poetic device. You need to understand that it is a poetic device. It is not meant to be taken literally. He is intentionally overstating something to make a case. That is fine to do. It doesn't mean the Bible is false, because the Bible also engages in hyperbole. Because the reader knows that it's a poetic device. Another example of this from the Old Testament. In the book of Judges and Joshua and 1 Samuel, in particular, in 1 Samuel, the Bible talks about how the Israelites wiped out this other group of people. They erased them from the face of the earth. They killed everybody, men, women, children, and all the animals. And this is something that people frequently are troubled by, because this would be genocide. And we're not cool with genocide for good reason. Genocide is not okay. But a couple of chapters later, the same people who have just been described as having been wiped off the face of the earth are causing problems for the Israelites again. So what is going on? Is this a contradiction? Were they wiped off the face of the earth or not? Well, this was written at a time when everybody talked about defeating their enemies in exactly the same way. It was a poetic device. If I say that the New York Yankees killed the Boston Red Sox, you don't file murder charges against the New York Yankees. You know that I'm being hyperbolic. I'm using larger than life language to describe how badly the Yankees beat the Red Sox. You know, in the context of sports, that murder did not just happen. And when you read the Bible, this is probably the first thing I want to tell everybody about reading the Bible. You have to read everything in the same way that the people it was written to would have read it. So if you're reading something that was written 2,000 years before Jesus was born, you need to read it in the way that those people 2,000 years before Jesus was born would have read it. If you're reading something 40 years after Jesus died, you need to read that in the way that first century Christians would have read it. And those could be totally different things. This is called genre. You're reading it within the genre. And this is how histories were written at the time, that they inflated their numbers, they inflated their victories. It doesn't mean they were lying. Everybody understood how it was being written and why it was being written that way. It was patriotism. It was nationalism. And the Bible writes within the genre of the people at the time. Not a contradiction. Here's a contradiction, though. And everybody is okay with this contradiction. We like this contradiction. And that is that God is described both as just and merciful. This is a complete contradiction. You cannot be just and merciful. Justice means getting what you deserve. And justice is very good news if you've done the right things, and very bad news if you have not done the right things. And we want justice. When justice isn't around, we hate it. We want justice to be in place because we want to get what we deserve, and we want to make sure that the people who aren't behaving appropriately or who are being evil, that they get what they deserve as well, and that is justice. Mercy is when you don't get what you deserve. And then there's another concept called grace. And grace is when you do get something that you don't deserve. And we love justice, mercy, and grace. And we often brag on God's character because he is both just and merciful, and he offers grace. And we love him for all three. And we should. How the heck, though, do you get away from the contradiction? You cannot be merciful to somebody and be just. You can't be perfectly just for sure if you're offering mercy. And this doesn't bother us at all. And I'm not saying we should be bothered by it. I'm pointing this out because there's another contradiction that we are bothered by. And somehow we aren't able to apply our satisfaction in the character of God in this other thing the same way we are when we talk about God's justice and mercy. And thank God he is just, and thank God that he is merciful. I'm not saying he needs to be one or the other. The Bible holds him as both at the same time. Thank goodness. The what came to mind was we were having a conversation in my life group. That's a weekly Bible study. And we were talking just briefly about God's sovereignty and whether or not God chooses who will be saved. And the Bible teaches this idea that men have free will. It's your own choice whether or not you're going to follow God or not. You can't force people into it. God isn't forcing people into it. The Bible teaches that men have free will, and men are free to do the right thing or the wrong thing. The Bible also teaches that God is sovereign, that his plans can't be thwarted, that whatever he wants to see happen will happen, and that God chooses who he's going to be merciful to. He chooses who he's going to save from their own sin. And this is a contradiction, and we are not okay with it. We are not okay with this contradiction. Entire denominations have been formed over which way you're going to lean on these two ideas, whether or not men have free will or if God is choosing people to save. And we're just not okay with it. We need resolution on this one. We don't need resolution on justice and mercy, but we do need resolution on this one. And, you know, I for sure lean towards the free will, that God is giving men free will to choose whether or not to follow him. I can't get away from all the verses that say he's sovereign. And I put great hope in the idea that he has plans that can't be thwarted by my free will or other people's free will. I do like that idea, but if we're going to say that God chooses who's going to be saved and who's going to be a Christian, well, that doesn't quite feel right to me. But I can't get away from the verses that actually say that explicitly. And what came to mind is that we're too small-brained. We're kind of stuck in a paradigm about time, and perhaps if we were able to get out of our own paradigm, or if we lived in a different plane than God, this would make more sense to us. And even within our own knowledge of physics, this kind of thing happens. There's something called the observer effect, and there's an experiment called the double slit experiment. When observing electrons, I'm going to butcher this. This is very, very poor way to describe what's happening. But electrons they have something known as superposition. They can exist in multiple states or locations at the same time. And somehow they put some barrier up with two slits in it, and the electrons can't get through the slits, or maybe they can, I don't know. But they start to build up around the slits. And then when somebody looks to see where the electrons are, which slit they're going through, the electrons choose a position. They get a position just because somebody has observed it. They exist in multiple locations or states at the same time. And then the minute they're measured, they collapse into a single definite state. I don't know what any of this means. I'll just flat out say, I don't know what that means. I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know how we know it. How could we possibly know that if when we observe something, then it's in one state? How do we know that it's in multiple states before we observe it? Maybe this is the way it is with free will and God's sovereignty. Maybe that both things exist at the same time. And then once God sees, you know, we say that God has perfect foreknowledge of the future. God looks into the future and he knows what's going to happen. And maybe by looking, that's when our free will is determined. And there is I am almost embarrassed to use this comparison, but in the Avengers movie, and some of you are like, oh yeah, I know where you're going exactly. Doctor Strange, at an important moment in the Avengers series, he has this time crystal that allows him to see into the future. And he meditates and he's trying to figure out what to do, what path to take. And he looks through all of these possible futures where everybody's free will decisions choose what's going to happen. And then he stops meditating and he says, there's only one path. And he does something to cause one path of decisions to happen. So the path moves forward and everybody makes their free will decisions based on the one thing that Dr. Strange forced them to do. He put everybody into a position and then their free will made their own choices. But did Dr. Strange cause that to happen? This is something in theologians call middle knowledge, that God looks at all possible futures and he chooses the path that will bring him the most honor and glory. And for some, that means that they will be saved and others they will not, based on their own free will decisions. Is that still free will when somebody determines the path that you will walk down? I don't know. My brain hurts about it a little bit. I acknowledge that both exist at the same time. It is a contradiction that is beautiful and troubling, just the same as justice and mercy. And one more thing about this. There's recent talk about extraterrestrials. The Trump administration has released a bunch of videos and files and testimonies of people who saw weird things that can't be explained. And I'm not doubting that those things exist, that there are weird things that can't be explained. I lean on the idea that those are not extraterrestrials. They're just things that haven't been explained. For example, I heard somebody say that a friend of theirs was seeing all kinds of UFOs, and then it turned out he was living near the Air Force base where they were testing the stealth bomber. And I don't know if you've ever seen a stealth bomber, but it looks like a spaceship. And if you have no idea what a stealth bomber is, and you happen to see one of those things flying around, spaceship is the thing that would make sense. That is how you would describe it. That's my own take about what we're seeing with all these anomalies. But maybe there are extraterrestrial beings. What we don't talk about enough, and maybe we should talk about more, is the idea of extra-dimensional beings. We are free to move within the third dimension. We can go up, down, sideways, however we want. We're three-dimensional beings, but we are trapped in the fourth dimension. We can only go forward in the fourth dimension. That's time. And maybe there are other beings like God who have the ability to move forward and backwards and sideways and up and down in time, just the same way we move about in the third dimension. And this is something that is not talked a lot about in science fiction, but occasionally it is. Occasionally, some science fiction writer will try to stretch their brain into what it could mean to live in a fourth dimension or fifth or sixth dimensional space. And one such novel is called The Three-Body Problem. It's by a Chinese author. And this guy is a genius, and I have no idea if what he's saying is true or if it works out, if his science is solid. But man, he makes my brain hurt a little bit. And if you're into that kind of thing, I would highly recommend The Three-Body Problem and the continuing books from that series. All that to say, I could be wrong. If you think I am, let me know. Let me know why. I had fun. I hope you did too. Buh-bye.